This time on Poll Hub, 'tis the season for food, family, and giving. But that's not always so easy for everyone. Food insecurity is climbing as food costs have jumped, and we're looking at what's being done to help. Then, AI is moving into every facet of our lives, including our playlists. Recently, an AI artist cracked the Billboard charts, so we're taking a test. Can we tell the difference between real music and AI-generated tunes? Can you? And we finish with a vacation fun fact. Will your answer depend on where you live? Let's find out. And hi, everybody. Welcome to Poll Hub. I'm J.D. Dapper.
I'm Barbara Carvalho.
And I am Lee Merengoff.
Many adults believe their diets are fairly healthy. And believe it or not, we have a lot of poll data to support this. According to Pew Research Center just this year, about 6 in 10 U.S. adults say that overall their diet is somewhat healthy. 21% actually say their diets are extremely or very healthy, and a comparable number, 1 in 5, say their diets are not too healthy or not healthy at all. Not surprisingly, according to Gallup poll, also done this year, upper-income and highly educated adults are more likely to say that they have healthy diets. 91% of respondents whose income level is $100,000 or more rate their diet as either very healthy or somewhat healthy. And interestingly, it's just a marginal difference, but 73% of respondents whose income level is lower than $50,000 rated their diet as very healthy or somewhat healthy. But underlying these perceptions is a very complex reality, because not everyone has equal access to fresh food or the same types of food, and especially those in food deserts. Also, millions of Americans rely on SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program that we heard so much about and was temporarily suspended during the government shutdown. But although this program, SNAP, is broadly popular, it is very much politically fraught. Joining us today is Deanna Jacob. She is the food systems coordinator at Dutchess Outreach. This is a local organization right here in our community in New York State, not too far from Marist University. And they have for many decades been part of this community and an advocate for food security as well as social equity. Deanna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, although we look at these national numbers and most people do say they are eating healthy, that they have access to food, when we think about any single percentage in a poll, so we can look at 10 or 15 or 20% of Americans who are having difficulties, those are huge, huge numbers. Proportionally, it doesn't sound like a lot. But millions of Americans are struggling, especially as food prices continue to rise. I mentioned food deserts. Tell me a little bit about what is meant by a food desert and how your organization tries to address those areas of community, you know, at least in our community, that experience those difficulties.
Sure. So a food desert is typically an area within community or county, town, whichever you may, you know, be looking at, and essentially does not have enough nutritious food within a drivable, walkable distance to folks. So it is something where you're not able to reach the foods that are a requirement for a nutritious diet.
And so when you're talking about nutritious foods, Tell me what that means so that we're all thinking about the same thing, because nutrition can mean, you know, a lot of different things to different people.
Absolutely. So that would be fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, fresh meats, dairy, anything that would be essentially a whole food that people could have access to.
So here in our community, what kinds of things is Dutchess Outreach doing to address some of these inequities?
So within Dutchess Outreach, we are addressing food insecurity in a way that is at the most emergent needs. So we're really supposed to be an emergency food provider, which would mean that it's when people are desperate for getting access to food. So that's why we have food pantry, and we also have a meal program, a lunchbox. Within those parameters, you're looking at a chronic food insecure issue. So it's not that we are unable to access food all the time, like a food desert. It's that we can't afford it. So you're seeing a lot of people coming to the food pantry, maybe because they aren't able to access the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or what people think of as food stamps, because they are above the poverty line. They could be just above the poverty line, which is asset limited income household. So you have to be about 228% below the poverty line to qualify for SNAP benefits.
Wow. Wow. And the benefits, you know, when you look at a family's food budget for a week, we kind of calculate it out that even if it's just an individual, if we calculate out the SNAP benefit for a month, it comes out to just a little under $10 a day for an individual. And so each of us can relate to the difficulty being able to afford fresh food with that kind of limited allowance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very difficult. I mean, our food pantries are supposed to be resources where it's just for an emergency where people really need it. But we're looking at a chronic issue across the board. And it's actually about $6 per day that people are able to live off for SNAP benefits specifically. So, I mean, if it's an individual that we're looking at, you have to make $19,000 a year to qualify to receive SNAP benefits. And if you are a family of four, it's, I believe, around $50,000 to be able to qualify for SNAP benefits. You have a very large margin in between that, where you're looking to feed your family, you have to pay rent, you have to worry about a lot of expenses, a car, especially when you're in a region like Dutchess County. You're not able to always access public transportation to get to and from work.
It's a little ironic that, you know, we live in the Hudson Valley, which is so known as a food place, right? We raise, you know, fruits and vegetables, and we have such a great agricultural economy, especially around healthy. Like, I mean, this locavore healthy stuff is all part of living in the Hudson Valley. And yet, when you talk about those numbers and those dollar figures, is it simply that while we have a lot of availability of food for people, especially healthy food for people, it really does come down to what's happened to food prices, and it's just not something people can afford? Is it as simple as just inflation and money, or is there more to it?
I would say that inflation has caused a great majority of the problem for people accessing the types of food that they need. I mean, I remember, you know, before COVID happened, a typical bill to go get groceries for my household was $100, let's just say. And that same bill that I would, you know, the same amount of items and everything has gone up to be about $200 for the exact same order of food. It's nothing's changed. And sometimes I even feel that it doesn't always equate to what I was getting before. You're seeing the term shrinkflation with a lot of things of access to food. But with the abundance of food that we have in our region, there is an issue with affordability. I think that we do have a lot of farms, but, you know, even the farmers' costs are astronomical in comparison to what they're able to sell for their food. They're getting
sure.
by.
Yeah, it's not their fault. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not their problem at all. It's just that the cost of transportation, you know, taxes even, everything.
Yeah, it's part of this that the SNAP, again, understanding that SNAP, you got to be quite poor, economically disadvantaged to even qualify for SNAP, but have SNAP benefits not caught up or kept up with what's happened to food prices?
No, it hasn't, actually. It has not caught up to food prices. That has been a battle over the years. We have, so there is an organization called the Alliance for Hunger Free New York, which is based out of the Capital Region. And each year they host a march on the Capital to talk about the increases that they want to see to SNAP recipients, to the hunger programs such as HIPNAP and Nourish New York that support our farmers that allow for them to produce more food for lower income individuals that can have it at a lower cost. I mean, the cost of food nationally, if we're talking about it, if we're looking at food that we eat, only 25% of the food that we produce in the United States is food that we eat. It is labeled as specialty crops on top of that. The food that we have, it's mislabeled down to the core, you know, and then on top of that, there's additional costs that come with it.
Yeah, I want to throw some numbers out there too, because in our kind of polarized political context, SNAP is not a polarizing issue, and food security is not a polarizing issue. 64% of registered voters, according to a Food Industry Association survey this year, 64% hold a favorable opinion of the government program. Only a third of Americans support cutting or reducing the program. Reasons for not cutting back. I mean, people say everyone deserves the right to eat. It helps low-income families. People rely on SNAP. There's a cost of living continues to go up, so we need to support this. So currently 42 million people, one in every eight Americans, does receive some kind of benefits under this program, and this is according to the USDA data. So it first of all, I mean, 75% of SNAP benefits are received by those at or below the poverty line, and 84% of SNAP benefits are received by households with a child or an older adult or a person with a disability. So this is actually a program that works. I mean, it can work better, particularly if the COLAs were kept pace with inflation. What kinds of things also? I mean, I know that organizations that are trying to deal with food insecurity tend to get very creative. So I know that you guys have the food pantry, the lunchbox, but you've got some other community programs as well to try to address the food insecurity issues locally. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Absolutely. So we have an additional program that I help run called the Farm Stand. So that program specifically, we get to come into the community 3 times per month. It's really been sponsored by our local government official, Dee Dee Barrett, in the 106th District. She was able to come through and support an additional 2 farm stands because initially Duchess Outreach has been hosting one for the past 8 years in the city of Poughkeepsie, but Dee Dee Barrett wanted one in the town of Poughkeepsie as well. So with her support, we've been able to implement 2 additional farm stand days. We are giving out about 13,000 pounds of food with each of these farm stands, and that is feeding our neighbors. We're seeing numbers of about 150 households, and it could be up to 600 people that we are feeding with the food that we receive for farm stands. That food is given from the regional food bank. It is typically food that is donated from other local grocery stores, honestly. We receive a lot of excellent food, even from Whole Foods. We're seeing amazing brands coming through and we're able to give to the public. So it's really fantastic when you have programs that are just all melding together and you have your local government official support on really bolstering the food security rates in their own town.
So, you know, we've just had Thanksgiving. We're heading into the holiday season. People do think about giving more and being able to help out their communities, particularly at this time of year. What is it that you would recommend to people if they want to be able to deal with this issue in their communities, and not just in the Hudson Valley, but around the country?
I would love to tell everyone that the folks that can bring the most, you know, money to their local food pantry are going to see the greatest impact be made to your local communities. Bringing it directly to those pantries is really important because they know their clients, they know the people, they're able to talk with their own communities, and they know what is best for them. So bringing it to your local food pantry is really the best way to help support your community.
Well, thanks so very much, Deanna. We appreciate the work that you do and Dutchess Outreach does and all of the other organizations in the Hudson Valley and beyond that are working to meet this very important need.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So AI has been a topic, a lot of people have been talking about AI in a lot of different ways. Obviously, it's a 3-year anniversary since ChatGPT broke on the scene, so there's been a lot of talk about that in the last few weeks, and I'm sure even over Thanksgiving, it was a topic at a lot of dinner tables because AI is really just getting infused into every single part of our lives, whether it is self-driving cars or ChatGPT, like we talked about, or art. So when I say art, I mean everything from writing to art to movies to music. And this segment is about music and AI. And what I want to do before we talk about anything else is I want to play 2 snippets of tracks for you guys, for all of us. And then I want to see if we can determine which one is an actual artist in front of a microphone singing and which one is completely created by AI. So let's give this a try.
He didn't walk me down no stairs. Didn't warn me about them boys who wouldn't care. Didn't tell me what a real man sounds like. So I fell for the ones that lied just right. He never pulled my chair or checked my friends. Never showed me what to lose or what to defend. So I chased love with an open wound, looking for something I was never introduced to.
Okay, so that's 1. You got that?
Yep.
Okay, so now let's go back and let's play another one and see what you think of this. Who is this real?
Ooh, I've never been who I want to be. Never felt completely free. No one's ever had all of me. Made me feel so beautiful and sexy. Now I'm flying like an airplane. Now I'm riding on.
Okay. Which one is AI and which one is actually a huge star and a real person?
Okay. Are the lyrics also AI and a real person?
No,
is it just the production?
It's the song itself, that what you're hearing is entirely generated by AI in one case and human generated in the other. The lyrics are written by a person. I don't know if the lyrics in the AI one were actually written by AI, although I believe that is the case.
Well,
yes.
I think it's obvious and it's a 50-50 chance. I will go with the first one was real and the second one was AI, or as we used to say, is it real or Memorex?
But yes, real or Memorex. I almost did that one, and then I realized that the three of us were the only people who'd know what I was talking about.
Yeah,
Barb?
Yeah.
I agree with Lee.
Oh, God. Could we just save that cut for future use?
Although the only thing, the only thing about the second one sounded like it was made in a studio.
Huh.
Well, the second one is Jennifer Hudson. It's a real person. Huge star.
Yeah.
The first
yeah.
one is Xenia Monet.
Ah,
oh,
yes.
There is no Xenia Monet.
Yeah.
But Xenia Monet is an AI created artist, including the video where there's a face and a person singing, and she's not a person.
Right.
But she's a big star.
Well, but you know what's interesting is the second one sounded like a studio mix. So that's why I leaned towards the AI on that one, where the other one sounded like it wasn't a studio mix.
Right.
And of course, that's the whole point of AI is to not sound fake.
Right. And there is no way, had I not been playing those, I would not have, and I didn't know the Jennifer Hudson song, I would have no way of knowing. They sounded identical.
The reason I asked about the lyrics was because I thought in the second one, it seemed almost as if you were requesting, you know, like make it more elongated in terms of the emotion of it and all. So I thought AI was taking it more literally, which is not a compliment to the Hudson team, I don't think.
Well, I mean, she's a big star with a big, she's big. I mean, she does big music. So that's probably where that was. Anyway, so Xenia Monet is a fully generated, AI-generated R&B gospel artist created by Mississippi poet and songwriter Talisha Nikki Jones. And she used generative AI platforms like Suno and others, and she does write lyrics, so I stand corrected. Those lyrics are hers, drawn from her own experiences, and then she produces the songs with digital tools. So the person singing it is not a person. The voice is not a person. It is all AI. And in this year, this just last few months ago, Xania became the first AI-driven artist to debut a billboard on the Billboard charts with her single, How Was I Supposed to Know? And later signed a multi-million dollar record deal. I guess
well, but
Talisha
but
Jones
I mean,
signed the deal. I don't think Xania Monet signed the deal since she is an AI artist. Anyway, while Jones describes Xania as an extension of herself, it is. It's an AI extension of herself, and she probably doesn't feel like she can sing or stand in front of a microphone or be in front of the camera and do the same thing. So is it good? Is it bad? Here's some data. According to IFPI's Engaging with Music report from this year, 79% of music fans believe that human creativity remains essential to the creation of music. 74% believe AI should not be used to clone or impersonate an artist without permission. I think I'm surprised it's only 74%. Back in 2023, before this became really widespread, the survey found that 52% of listeners fear that AI could devalue or replace human-made music. Yet 43% of Gen Z listeners said they were open to discovering new AI-created songs. And overall sentiment, real quick, from Pew last month or 2 months ago, found 53% of people say AI will worsen people's ability to think creatively, compared to 16% who say it'll improve it. And most Americans, 76%, say it's extremely or very important to be able to tell if pictures, videos, artists, music, all that is made by AI or people. They want to see labels. They want to know. But only 47% feel they're confident they'd be able to guess right. We guessed wrong. So anyway, what do you make of this? I mean, because it is, you know, there's technology that has been involved in all creation of art. So as soon as somebody plugged in an electric guitar, people said, oh, that's not music. As soon as people used a synthesizer, oh, that's not music. As soon as people use video to record, to make art, it's like, well, that's not art. It's not paint. So is this just that, or is there something different?
You know, I tend to be an AI advocate. And do I recognize that there need to be guardrails, that I think transparency is very important? But I do see it as a tool. And I think, as you point out, this is obviously a talented artist. She's a poet, I think, by her own characterization and admission. And it's a way of her being able to express her talent and her art. So I see it as a tool. As long as we have transparency, we have guardrails, so people are not stealing other people's creative work. And I know that that is not an easy thing to be able to regulate. I think it's very exciting.
Yeah, to put your analogy and Barb's point together, isn't it the case, though, that when we've had other technological advances, that also involved creativity? And so the notion that this diminishes creativity, I understand, but yet this just didn't happen out of thin air. There's somebody who's providing AI with some direction, I assume, so that they don't end up with a Beethoven symphony, but they ended up with this styled song. So I think that, you know, I think it's probably a little harsh to say this is an absence of creativity when, in fact, so many other things, electric guitars, I mean, they changed the sound. This sort of mimics existing sound, I guess, but is in that genre or in that tradition of advances. I mean, obviously, this one's a little more extreme, but, you know, I did find that also people are more concerned in the poll numbers from Pew than excited about the increase of AI in this regard in our daily life. And so I think that there is not a fear, but certainly a questioning of the unknown. But that's not unusual when something comes through and breaks new ground.
And I think it's also going to be a very interesting few years, few decades, perhaps. Isn't most art also in some way derivative? I mean, we were touring many of the museums of Spain and France a few months ago, And the characterization was, well, these were the artists that this particular artist admired. This is how he interpreted the same scene that this particular artist that had done perhaps a century prior to him. And particularly when it comes to music, a lot of music is derivative from other works of music, both from all genres. So, you know, how do we balance that now that it's not just your local composer, you know, in the next town, but it can be any composer that has existed really on the planet for centuries?
Well, as so much in life, there is a monetary aspect to this too. And a global study by CISAC projected that music industry workers could lose as much as 24% of their income over the next few years due to AI's increasing role in music production. I think that's, we made the very best case scenario. This is a poet who actually writes lyrics and has created an avatar, if you will, for her art. But an awful lot of AI-generated music now, and we see it in platforms where you're, if, even in this podcasting editing platform that we have, that we use, there is AI music that we can, you know, put in if we want. If we want to have a music bed and it's AI-generated music and there's no human involved at all. So I do think there's using it as a tool, like we've described with a synthesizer, electric guitar, whatever it is, studio production. And then there's having no human in the loop and simply saying, you know, AI, make me an upbeat song. I need a 3-minute song. I need a guitar line. I need a bass line. I need it to work with a presentation I'm doing to a conference of dietitians. I want it upbeat and I want it cheery and I want a female vocalist and the lyrics should be banal. You know, and boom, you've got a 3-minute song, but no human in the loop. I think that may be.
So, Jay, are you talking about a whole industry of session, you know, right, musicians who show up and kind of do their thing? And what if we want to see some of this being made? I mean, what are you going to show, a picture of a laptop?
So most music now is not, most music, there's huge amounts of studio stuff in it, so you don't really see it. Videos of music are a performer doing something, but this Xenia, she's got a video, so you can make the video too. I just think that there's a difference between this one case. This is almost an edge case, and it's the best edge case. And then there's where this is likely to go, which is into a lot of generic, like elevator music kind of stuff that even people aren't. Not that elevator music was the height of art, but it's completely produced by a computer, by AI, and there's no human in the loop, and there's nobody makes any money off of it. I don't know. I think there's a difference.
Well, I think that AI is certainly a disruptive technology, and we're going to see it in really every aspect of our lives and in every sector. And I think there are benefits. There are going to be certainly drawbacks. But I think that we need to make sure that we keep the human part of creativity and the use of AI. Even in your song, Jay, you had quite a talented description of what you wanted. AI was not just coming up with a song. You had, you know,
that was a prompt.
I was about to say that if you were writing that prompt or speaking that prompt to one of our favorite LLMs, that you would be very specific and it would very much be a Jade Dapper creation.
Yeah, so here's the thing for me. So, you know, this has an opportunity, I think, for people who don't have good voices. I can actually create something now that goes very lucrative in the field of voice and music, and just by prompting, you don't have to hear my monotone. You can actually just see something that. But here's another. Let me get Neil deGrasse Tyson, who a lot of you know is, you know, the whiz of all things astronomy and transgalactical. But his point is on the difference between science and art. He says that science obviously is, you can replicate it, and if someone didn't invent electricity, you know, somebody else would have, or the Wright brothers, it would have happened. Somebody else would have done it. But his argument is that when art, if Beethoven didn't write the symphonies, nobody else would have written those symphonies, okay, the way Beethoven wrote them. And, you know, true for the Beatles or whoever you want to go with as creating a unique artistic sound that was not necessarily going to occur had they not done it. So it's unique to the artist. Does that get lost a little bit in this when you're just saying, give me a prompt? Yeah, I want a female singer. I want a, you know, a sand song. I want it, you know, whatever, the different things. Does Neil deGrasse Tyson not like this?
Well, we'll have to have him on. Yeah, we'll have to have him on to ask. I think it's the difference between art and science in that way. This is blends that, right? This crosses that line because it's not human generated art, even the prompt. The prompt is human generated, but what is produced is entirely, you know, outside of the human loop. So I don't know. We'll have to have him on to find out. But my guess is he might say that's a gray area, or he probably has a better physics term for that.
Yeah, like a black hole.
Okay, before we move into the fun fact, I want to just kind of like spill over from the last segment and ask our student producers what they think of the debate between real and fake or AI-generated music. Sylvia, where do you go with this?
I'm not a huge fan of it personally. I get the argument that, you know, it gives people who maybe have the lyrics but not the singing voice to produce their own music. But I really do value like the creativity of these artists. So if you're just putting it, like plugging it into a computer, I debate, grapple with how much of an art it actually is. I would rather listen to like an actual artist that I could go see live or something.
Do you think it's important that you know that they say it's an AI artist?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that we can have, you know, people thinking that their new favorite artist is a real person and then it's actually a robot. Same with anything you see like on social media. I think clarifying when it's AI is super important.
So you don't see this as a continuum from, you know, electric guitars and now we down the line we end up with AI. You see it as a real break.
Yeah, I mean with the change in, you know, or art from painting to video, you still have a human producing that. This isn't necessarily a human.
Like, now, was this a segment that you produced or no?
No, this is AJ's segment.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's presenting his capping project. He would like to have been here, but he is doing the academically correct thing.
Well, but we have AJ on as an AI, and he's just going to talk about it.
No, but we do have Molly. So what is Molly?
Molly, where do you fall on this question? Because it's certainly one that's going to, it's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I would definitely choose a real person over AI. I think that, like, definitely for, like, paintings and, like, music, it's more, like, valuable if it's coming from a real person. And I think, like, definitely in the future when people are making, like, paintings and such, like, I wonder if they're going to spend the amount of money they usually do now on, like, something that is just made from the computer, not, like, a real person.
Mm. Well, but what about like EDM, you know, another kind of electronic, you know, music?
Yeah, EDM is completely computer generated. Yeah. So is that different because a person is actually writing and programming the computer?
I mean, I love EDM, so I would say it's so different.
It's amazing and it's fun. And,
but we're going to have so many new rules in this, all this, because we have painting by numbers. Well, is that art?
That's always been art. That's the only painting I could do, so I'm going to defend that.
Yeah, all right, anyway. let's switch gears to the fun fact, although this has certainly been interesting and fun in and of itself. But we do have a question from the year 2015, which is CBS News put together, and they asked a national audience, in which season are you most likely to go on a trip, summer, spring, fall, or winter? And the summer was the not surprising leader of that at 53%. But I think we're going to hear in this discussion cases for and reasons for spring, which was 15, fall, which was 15, and winter, which was 13. So summer dominates the time for going on trip. But, you know, there's double digits for the other three seasons. Well, come on, start with the students this time. Sylvia, where you fall on the time to go away?
This is kind of a hard one because growing up, my parents are professors. So when we did our family vacations, we just did them when class wasn't in session. So a lot of our family trips were during the summer or during my parents' spring break, not necessarily my spring break, but, you know, I think going forward, a winter getaway is always really enjoyable. especially if you're going somewhere nice and warm. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that something like that pulls through for me this year, but we'll see.
So Molly, when would you pack your bags and head off for distant lands?
I would definitely say summer. I just feel like that's the time where I'm most available. Also, I think weather-wise, summer is just like the best season to go on vacation because you can go to like warm places. But I definitely was surprised by the winter percentage because I do think a lot of people go on vacation during the holidays. So
yeah.
That surprised me. Yeah.
Now, I think Jay and Barb, I'm going to take a guess on this, given that my last guess of 50-50 was wrong.
We all got that wrong. That's why.
Yeah. So anyway, but I'm going to guess.
And then I absurdly agreed with you.
Yeah. Well, we're keeping the
phrase.
Why
would I
phrase,
have done that?
We're going to edit the phrase, I agree with Lee, and we'll just put it into every podcast.
Yeah, exactly. You've got me now.
Yeah, I've got that now on record. But I think Jay and Barb are going to say something a little bit more for non-summer breaks.
Barb, I'll let you see
well,
if Lee's
well,
right.
Actually, I'm going to question the question. Because, you know, when are you most likely to go on a trip? Well, you know, I work in an academic setting at Marist University. So certainly in terms of the time available and when, you know, things are a little bit quieter on campus, I would always think summer. But if I reflect back on my last few vacations, I haven't taken a summer vacation in quite a number of years. So I think there is an issue of validity in this question. And although it sounds like most, you know, you are most likely to go, perhaps they should have asked, you know, when did you last go on a trip? You know, summer, spring, fall, or winter. And then they would get a better sense of perhaps the patterns.
Well, what's your favorite?
Of Americans.
If you could choose, what would be your favorite time to go? That would be another way to do it, right?
Oh, perpetual vacations, you know, I would go to some place, you know, warm in the winter,
yes.
A little cooler in the summer. So, yeah, I would.
Yeah, that gets at the validity thing about region, too, Lee. So if you ask this of people who live in the South, winter is probably not going to be high on the list. If you ask people in the Northeast or Minnesota, I'm going to guess you're going to get a summer is going to be up there, but you know, winter would be up there too. So I don't know. I like vacations.
Yeah, if they can get out of their airport.
Right. If you can get out. Yeah. So my answer would be all of the above. And that was not one of the options.
That's true.
But Jay, to Barb's point, when was the last time you went, what season, on a significant vacation?
I mean, I took a week this summer, but then I'm going to be taking a winter. It did went last winter. I usually do summer and winter, but take some time. Summer is actually, you know, it is for academic reasons, but winter is actually, we have spring break here, and then we also have a long winter break where the students are out until mid-January. So, you know, there's opportunities to get away in winter, too.
Yeah, I think this might bring forth a Yogi Berra-ism about say that people don't go to restaurants anymore because they're so crowded. And I think this one makes by analogy, I think people might say, you know, people don't do summer vacations anymore because there's just so many people doing it.
That are on vacation, yeah. No, that would work.
Too many tourists, very crowded. But I guess I like the non-summer vacations. I know it's easier to get away in the summer for us given our real job, day jobs. But I think, you know, going in the spring, going in the fall, going winter, yeah, kind of change of pace kind of thing. And as they say, people are going to be doing it because no one's doing it anymore. But I don't know what Mr. Barrow would have to say about that. But anyway, an interesting topic.
That'll do it for Poll Hub this week.
Poll Hub is produced by the Merit Poll at Marist University in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Mary Griffith is our executive producer.
Casey Schaff is our production supervisor.
The Poll Hub team includes AJ Gambino, Tommy Rogers, Cassie Connors, Sylvia Weiser, and Molly Goodger.
If you enjoy Poll Hub, consider telling a friend about us.
If you'd like to learn more about polling and survey science, check out the Marist Poll Academy, our free online learning portal accessible from our website.
Remember, you can always tell your smart speaker to play Poll Hub, and with any luck, it'll cooperate.
Finally, wherever you listen to Poll Hub, there is a subscribe button. Click it, and the latest episode will be ready for you in your podcasting app as soon as it's released.
We'll see you next time.